listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage Regional Originals brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Hanna S. Sharif. Hanna is a director, playwright, producer, and currently serves as the Associate Artistic Director at Baltimore Center Stage. She served as Associate Artistic Director, Director of New Play Development, and Artistic Producer at Hartford Stage and Program Manager of the Arts Emerson Ambassador Program. She has directed at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Marin Theater Company, Baltimore Center Stage, Hartford Stage, and Midtown Arts, among many others. She's the recipient of a DC Arts Best Director, Best New Play Award, and a Connecticut Critics Circle Award, Best Ensemble, and a handful of nominations for a legendary production of Gem of the Ocean. She has just been named the new Artistic Director of Repertory Theater of St. Louis, a role she assumes in June 2019. Hanna, thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's exciting.
Yeah. We're here in Marin Theater Company, where you are directing a production of Ayad Akhtar's...
The Who and the What.
The Who and the What.
Opening night.
Tonight.
Yes.
And the first question I'd love to ask you is, where did you grow up and how did you find the theater? How did the theater find you?
So I grew up in Texas. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, but I was raised in Houston, Texas. I don't remember a time where I really wasn't involved with the theater. If you ask my mother, she would tell you I was a very dramatic child. I don't know that that's actually true, but that's the mythology. I was a writer very young. I fell in love with writing and expressing myself through that medium. And I directed my first play really young. I think it was 17. And fell in love with being able to curate the world. And then when I was in college at Spelman College in Atlanta, I started a theater company with a handful of friends called Nasir Productions. And that was a place where I feel like I really cut my teeth as a producer. Like, you know, it's a small theater company. You're wearing 100 different hats, like all of us, you know, have come up that way have. So you might be directing one show, an artistic director of this, but you're also the lighting designer, the marketing director, and you're taking out the garbage. And it was an exciting time where we were really scrappy and just doing the work that we loved, and because we didn't know any better, that no one told us that we couldn't. And that was also an incredibly exciting time for me in developing a sense of who I wanted to be in the world and the way I wanted to tell stories. I had a moment about 5 years into the running of that company where I remember waking up and feeling like there has to be a better way of doing this, that we were so scrappy and we were doing everything. And I just thought 20 years from now, I could still be running this company and maybe we'll have grown to being, you know, $1 million company or whatnot. But that there had to be best practices that those of us who came to the company just from our passion didn't know. And so I made this decision that while I was in grad school that I was going to go to a regional theater, because I figured, you know, those multi-million dollar theaters, they have to know how it's done, right? They have to have some tricks to the trade. And so I always say that my intention when I first went to Hartford Stage was to go in and steal the master's tools. I was going to go in, I was going to do 2 years, I was going to learn everything I could about everything that I could. And then I was going to come back to my small scrappy theater company, and we were going to produce things with a more streamlined, more efficiency. My mother always says, you plan and God plans, and God is the best of all planners. Because I went to Hartford thinking that I would be there for 1, maybe 2 years, and I stayed for 10.
Yeah.
And that was an exciting time. I say that I grew up in the theater at Hartford Stage. Michael Wilson was the artistic director who hired me. Christopher Baker and Jeremy Cohen were all there during my early years in Hartford. Yes. And it was an incredibly exciting time in the American theater, time during the tenure. And I was the youngest voice. I was the only female voice. And I was the only person of color in the entire institution for a considerable part of my 10 years there. And so I feel like... it was a pivotal moment of understanding who we are as a field, being in a position to open doors to other writers and directors who perhaps would not have had their names on the the table early on, and recognizing the real importance of having diverse voices in protosorial positions. I always say that Michael gave me one of the greatest gifts of my career. When I first got to Hartford Stage, he made me the artistic liaison to every department, which meant that I was in every marketing meeting, every development meeting, every finance meeting, every education meeting. My job was to be able to articulate to each of the departments in the language that they understand the vision and mission of the art.
Yeah.
And to also be able to carry back to executive leadership where there were tensions and concerns and how we could address those things in order to achieve the large scale ideas. And so I truly believe that that opportunity and that work and at such an early point in my career really helped fine tune my skills as a producer. And because I came to the work directing, writing, I understood myself as an artist, but I really wanted to understand what it meant to create and curate at the scale that mid to large size regional theaters were doing. And it's really served me, that gift has served me. That's been the gift that's kept on giving
that's
for the last 20 years.
That's an incredible experience.
Yeah.
I feel like not a lot of theater companies actually always even have that connectivity within their institution. I feel like sometimes institutions can be really siloed, and what a great gift for you and for Hartford Stage. Is there a piece of art that, or a play maybe, that has changed your life?
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
So many. The first play I remember seeing, I was, I think, 5, and it was at the Miller's Outdoor Theater in Houston, Texas, and it was Porgy and Bess. And it's like imprinted on my DNA, that experience. Another kind of early play, my father took me to see A Soldier's Story,
mm-hmm.
Which I was probably way too young to be seeing at the time that I was seeing it. But again, like when I think back to like when someone says, what are your earliest memories of the theater? Those plays come up. If I'm thinking about understanding myself as an artist and being able to dig into the abstraction of work, I would say that Adrian Kennedy's Funny House of a Negro was incredibly important to me. I think that one of the best written plays of all time is Long Day's Journey into Night. I think it's a play that has become it is the prototype for so many of our contemporary American writers, and it is a play that I love passionately. I had so many. One of the musicals that I thought was extraordinary because it broke my concept of the musical form was Bring on the Noise, Bring on the Funk.
Yeah.
And I love music. I love musicals.
Yes.
And so many different types of musicals. But that, when I saw that, I went to New York to see it, and I thought, oh, right. There are no rules that can hold great art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are so many. I fell in love very, very early in my career with partly because I am a playwright and partly because I believe that the field continues to have relevancy, not just by looking back to the classics, but by really embracing and developing and nurturing new voices. And so I've been passionate about new play development and the evolution of new play development in this country for the entirety of my career. And so I would say that my favorite happy place is sitting with a pile of scripts from writers that I'm just meeting or learning about. And the exciting thing about being where I am right now is that there's so many writers that I feel like we've grown up in the business together.
Yes.
And we're all kind of coming, you know, forward.
Yes.
and becoming kind of primary voices at the same time. And that's an exciting thing. You know, you turn on the Tonys and it's all your friends on stage, right?
Right.
It's the people that you came into the business with who are there. And It's. I think we're really in a golden era for the American theater. Big challenges ahead, but I don't know. I think we've come full cycle to another moment where so much is possible. An expansion of what we understood theater to be is possible.
Yes. You have spent so much time doing new play development. What are some of your methodologies, and what have you learned in your long time doing this work?
Yeah, you know, I think of I think new play development programs fundamentally have to be of service to the playwright. Playwright first. Edward Albee was my playwriting mentor, and he very much believed that the playwright was king. So I think that I believe that fundamentally we should approach the work by asking a playwright what they need. What are the resources that they need? Is it time? Is it space? Putting together, curating with the playwright, the right developmental team, a dramaturgical director, someone who has an eye for form, who knows how to bring to surface the important questions.
Yeah.
I'm just not interested in being prescriptive to playwrights. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a talent and a genius in that, and that our jobs as institutions is to give them space and resources to be able to find their voices and to curate around them the team of people who understand structural questions that they can raise for the playwright to figure out how to fix. So I think great dramaturgs, dramaturgical directors, more time and resources to workshop and in privacy, right? Not the kind of workshop a play to death, right? But actually creating space for playwrights to come in, work with the actors without a public audience, without any expectation. I'm very much interested in the no strings attached. How can we be of service to writers without having to necessarily take ownership of the work and the process? One of the things that I think is exciting that's been a shift in the last kind of, I would say, 10 to 15 years is seeing more theaters collaborating with each other.
Yeah.
It's not just about being able to be the sole commissioner of a piece, but co-commissioning with another organization. I'm very interested in the writers that I believe in who have more commissions than they know what to do with.
Yeah.
How can I help you? How can we create a space where you can bring those commissions in, workshop them here, and then send them off into the world? That it's not just about having the world premiere at my theater. It's
right.
about the work that we're putting forward to the field, for the field, and how that is helping evolve the national conversation about our art form.
Does your work as a playwright inform the way that you direct new plays?
I think that my work as a playwright makes me sensitive to the journey that a writer is on, and understanding that there's no one-size-fits-all way of approaching the development of new work, that every playwright has their own process, and my goal is to be as supportive and rigorous.
Yeah.
And that combination, I think, is important. That we can't shy away from the hard questions, from the tough questions, that if you have a, you know, one of the things that was really wonderful about Baltimore that was a little bit different from Hartford is that Kwame, because he's also a playwright, he would program a play that hadn't been written yet. Right? So we would be in season planning conversation. He's like, I've had this conversation with this playwright and I really love this idea and I want us to produce it a year from now. So we're going to commission it. We're going to throw developmental resources behind it. And we're already committing before there is, you know,
yes.
not a ink to paper yet,
right.
A production. And so what was really wonderful about the last 5 years is that it's a different muscle than when you are in when you're running a new play development program, that's just about like the developmental process for the playwright.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you are like, we're on a 13-month timeline.
Yes.
From idea to stage, what is the rigor of that support process? How do you serve the playwright without, you know, pushing them into a process that doesn't work for them, but also make sure that there's real rigor to the investment that you're making in the year of development? And so that was really wonderful. It was a shift in gears, and I feel like I learned a tremendous amount about how you take a play from inception to stage in a very short period of time. I think we probably did that in the last 5 years. There were at least four plays
Wow.
that were programmed either before they were written or early in their writing stages. And I also appreciate like what it means as an institution to say, I have such faith in you as a writer. I believe in you and your work, and I'm willing to invest right now, not just in helping you get this play written, but to produce it, get you to your first production and to introduce this play to the world. And I feel like that level of commitment is really important too.
Can I ask you to define rigor in the context that you were just using it? Because I feel like that's very... because I feel like a lot of theaters will want to, like, apply rigor, but I feel like the precise tools may be a bit ambiguous to some of them.
Yeah, I mean... as the kind of producer, one part of it was being really clear about timeline, mm-hmm. right? So working with the playwright around starting with, if we're committing to production, here are the production timelines.
Yeah.
Here's when we
this
meet.
Draft, this reading, this workshop.
Here's the production timeline, and then we work backwards, right?
Uh-huh.
We need the final draft by X date in order for the show to be designed
yes.
and for us to go into rehearsal on that day. Now let's work backwards. Where are you in process? What does it look like? What does your timeline look like? Let's be really clear about first draft. Let's be clear about first workshop, second workshop, third workshop. In-house, New York, where are we going to be? What are the resources that you need? Is there a research portion to this project and process? How do we support that? And then internally, depending on what the team is that's around that piece, so we would have, you know, the director, there's a dramaturg attached to it, and then those of us who also have dramaturgical eyes and artists would kind of collectively work. Drafts come in, get together, make sure that we've all had our responses, individual responses, group responses, and then depending on what the process of the playwright is. Some playwrights were like, I want to come to the room. I want the four of you who've been with me on this journey. Give me all your notes. And others are like, I don't want to hear from four people. I want to hear from one person. Make sure
yes.
you have those words.
Yes.
You're all on the same page about what you're saying to me. Let me have them, and I will take what is valuable to
yes.
me out of them. And so being able to make sure that the clarity of process is there for everyone involved in the developmental process, and that we hold each other accountable to the extent that you can.
Yes.
Things happen, timeline shift, that's not what's important.
Right.
Are we still moving forward? Is the play making the types of leaps that you want it to make, that the playwright wants it to make more so than what I want, that the playwright wants to make? Are we still on the right trajectory in order to get to a production? And I think that structural questions that go to the heart of what the playwright is expressing their goal with the play is, the story that they want to tell, being really honest the word that I'm looking for. The word that keeps coming up is rigorous, but I'm trying to define define it. I don't want to use it to define itself, but I think being as thoughtful as possible in the questions that you're asking.
Yes.
And then again, I think there's also this process of, like, sometimes I've experienced where we're working with playwrights and there's a lot of, like, information being given, a lot of thoughts being given, a lot of questions being given, and then that's it. Like, here are all the questions, now you go away and do what you will with it, rather than, here are the questions, you take some time, let me check back in and see what's valuable to you, what do you need, is there something that, you know, was this part of the process valuable? Is there something else you want us to mine? Do you want to go back into the room and play for another two uh-huh. days to kind of sketch some of these ideas very quickly? You know, what is it you need, and how can we be nimble enough and flexible enough to be responsive in the
yes.
way that the playwright needs us to be responsive?
I want to work on a new play at your theater. Do you see new plays differently as a director than you do classics? Is there just inherently a different way that you read them or think about them as a director?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I have never thought of it in that way. I'm always looking, when I'm as a director, at what I find emotionally compelling in the play and what has urgency to me. And I think that, so when anytime I'm embracing a classic or approaching a classic, I feel like I am approaching it with my contemporary sensibilities.
Sure.
Even if, you know, which doesn't mean that it has to be, you know, like, Julius Caesar in outer space,
right?
But what are the most kind of urgent, pressing, ideas and emotional impulses that draw me to this play? How do I find myself in this journey? And I feel like that's true whether I'm working on a new play or a classic. What I think about is different. This is maybe not the greatest thing, but I do feel when I'm working on a new play, fundamentally as a director, my job is to be of service to the playwright and to uplift the vision of the playwright. And I feel like there's a little more freedom when you're working with a classic to say, oh, what is my...
Right.
How do I want to tell this story?
Yes.
And I think that in particular, when you're working with a new play, my impulses as a director are to be as supportive of the story and journey in the way that the playwright visions it.
Yeah.
And that each, the other reason why I think this idea of like the rolling world premiere where you have a play, you know, it's like How to Catch Creation this year, which has production at the Goodman, a production at Baltimore Center Stage, co-produced with Philadelphia, and then a production at OSF. That's exciting for a playwright.
Yeah.
To have a new play, have four productions in 1 year, multiple directors taking on the piece.
Different spaces, different audiences.
Yes, and multiple opportunities to go back in and continue the crafting work. I think it's, you know, I think Christina's play is exceptional and incredible.
Yeah.
And I think she's, it's an interesting moment. I'm like, oh, I would love to talk to her at the end of this year.
Yeah.
To see what the experience was to have this play produced at four different theaters in 1 year. And, you know, what that felt like, what, you know, I would love just to get feedback on what that experience is, because I think that it's an interesting model, and I think it's one that we may see more of.
Yes.
And I think that there are probably some real advantages to it for the writer, separate from it's really great to get, you know, royalties on four productions in one season.
Sometimes it can be hard to get that second production.
Absolutely.
You know, sometimes you put a play out there and then nobody, because it's not going to be a world premiere for that theater, they're like, well...
Yeah.
Rather do something new.
Yeah.
What's your rehearsal room like? How do you like to conduct a rehearsal process? Do you spend a lot of time doing table work? What do you enjoy?
So I do spend time at the table.
Yeah.
I'm a deconstructionist at my core. My poor husband is like, do we have to deconstruct everything? Yes, we do. I do spend time, no matter what the play is or musical is, at the table. I think it's an important part of like finding, for me, separate from being able to talk about the play and to, you know, start to deconstruct and pull the threads apart, it's also a way of making sure that everyone involved in the process is fully onboarded in the journey, right? As we're talking together and figuring out where we all connect. And it's an opportunity to really seed over the course of days what the goals are and vision is for the production moving forward. And not just in the like, first day of rehearsal, here's my speech about what I was thinking and here are the designers talking. It's actually being able to kind of get into the DNA of the play and to help the artists involved in the production see how those threads interconnect. So I do spend time at the table. You know, after that, it really depends on what the play is and what the needs are and how short or long my rehearsal period is.
Yeah.
When I'm dealing with a shorter rehearsal period, I try and get a sketch of the play on its feet. I say, we're just going to put the bones together. There's no meat. There's no flesh. There's no...
Yep.
Let's just get a pass through.
Yep.
Let's physically find our way. Let's emotionally find some of the little peaks and valleys, just even the sketch of them, so we know, oh, that's a hard one.
Yeah.
I find that to be really helpful in giving us a roadmap and then doubling back and being able to really dig down and do the deep dive into, you know, scene by scene, moment by moment, breath by breath through the play. And then there's that pass, and then depending on the time, we just keep,
yes,
you know, working through, moving through, and also running so that we get to feel what it means to string things together in our bones. If I have a more leisurely rehearsal process, we might spend a little more time rather than doing a kind of quick sketch for the bones. We might spend a little more time finding our way through the first pass.
Mm-hmm.
I in my head, and I think it's just this probably, I believe it started when I became a mother, like this need to like maximize every moment. So I do a kind of like calendar of where I want to hit by what period of time in order to make sure I can hit the benchmarks. It never ends up being the same thing in reality, but it at least makes me feel better that I pretended that there was a plan.
Right.
And I love collaborating. I believe fundamentally in our art form as a collaborative one. And so I'm really specific about the creative teams that I put together because I trust and invest so deeply with the other artists that are on the journey with me. I like when I can to hand select the assistant director because I think they're an important part of the process. I love to use them. And I have generally great relationships with my stage managers because, you know, I feel like every day we walk in the room and we're the team.
Yes, yes.
I think that I don't believe when I start a process that I have all the answers.
Right.
I believe that we're going to discover, there's the genius is in the discovery in the room.
Yes.
And I am someone who believes that casting well is really important. I have learned more from great actors in space, you know, than I have, you know, just deconstructing in my own mind. And it's one of the great joys of this part of what we do that's very different than my work as a playwright. My work as a playwright is very... at times isolating. I go into my cave and I close the door and I write until I, you know, can't see straight, and then I sleep for a couple hours and I get up and I write some more.
What a joy.
And there's a part of me that loves that.
Yeah.
But I also understand that I don't know that that could be my whole life because the other part of me loves being in the room with all of the artists, you know, tearing things apart and sharing ideas and playing. You know, I really do think that it's such a joy that we get paid.
Yes, to play.
But it's purposeful play. It's play with intentionality. I have my very own, very real spiritual practice. And fundamentally, I believe... This is my personal belief, not in any way projecting on anyone else. But I believe that, you know, we are here to serve, you know, whatever you call that higher power. And for me, the way I serve what I call God is by serving humanity. And the way to serve humanity for me is through this art form. That it is through the work that we are able to confront the frailties of ourselves, that we are able to dig down and reflect back the best and worst of ourselves, that we're able to ask ourselves the fundamental questions about what it is that connects us.
Yeah.
And that there's magic when we put that on stage and 600 people sit in the dark every day. 600 strangers come together to sit in the dark to have this uniquely singular and communal experience at the same time. And that none of us can control what each person is receiving or taking away from the experience, but that there's an energy exchange happening in every theater across this country, you know, six nights a week, eight shows a week. That's powerful, right? That's powerful. Yeah. That's a powerful exchange. That is a spiritual exchange.
Yes.
And I think fundamentally sharing stories... And being able to find yourself in worlds that you never would have imagined yourself in.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That you see a story and you're like, that has nothing to do with me.
Yes.
And then suddenly, by the end of the night, there are 17 ways you found yourself.
Right.
In this Muslim American family on stage here at Marin, or in Fun Home, the musical, you know, that you find yourself in that, and that it reframes how you see the world and how you see the people next to you. That fundamentally, when we do our best work, is transformational.
Yeah.
And is about empowering the kind of spiritual world that we live in.
Yeah.
And for me, like, at our best, that's why I get up every day to do this work.
Yeah.
And even when I feel like, well, fell short today, it's still better than anything else I can imagine doing.
That's right. Every time I go to the theater, I say a little prayer, like, please let me be transformed tonight. Like, mm-hmm. please let me leave the theater changed yeah. from when I came in. And who knows, you know?
It's so true. And, you know, it's so funny, like, being in the business, I feel like it can be easy to get jaded about certain things because you're just around it so yeah. much. When my daughter, summer before my daughter's first grade year, every summer she issues a challenge to herself. And
I love her daughter so much.
and then if she completes the challenge that she lays out for herself, she also gets to pick her reward. And so summer, kindergarten, first grade, she said, I'm going to read 100 books this summer. And I said, okay, what do you want at the end of the summer if you complete your 100 mm-hmm. books? And she said, I want to go see a Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
I said, great. She completed her, she went above 100 books over the summer.
Can she be my life coach?
and so I said, well, what show do you want to see? And she went back and forth between The Lion King, which she'd never seen, she uh-huh. loves the movie, had never yep. seen the play. And Anastasia, which she also loved the book and never seen the play. And, you know, Darko, who's dear friend yes. and former artistic director, directed that. So I was like, well, let's go see that one. And so she's like, but she made the decision. I mean, literally in the ninth hour, she's like, I think I want to see The Lion King. And so I'm like, okay, we'll get these tickets to go see The Lion King, which I saw 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? I forgot until I saw that play with my daughter, just how life-affirming and transformational and powerful that play is. There's a reason it's still running.
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason there are so many. Like, that, and I, you know, I feel like in my mind, because Lion King comes into every city, I was kind of like, yeah. oh, it's Lion King again?
Yes.
My daughter couldn't stay in her seat.
Yeah.
Right? She's like clinging to the chair in front of her. I'm like, someone's sitting there. You have to move your hands. You know? On her feet, just transformed. And I was transformed, not just watching her. I was having this experience again. And I was like, I forgot. This is actually one of the most incredible things I've yes. ever seen in my entire life. And the imagination and the joy and the sense of light overcoming darkness in 2017.
Yes, yeah.
It was very, very special, and it was a great reminder to me of why it's important, and that it doesn't stop being important because it's not new anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And how wonderful that you were both transformed, you know, not only with each other, but probably because of each other as well. Mm-hmm. Because that's what this coming together
yeah.
means. So changing topics just a little bit, you know, this program is based on directors working in the regions.
Yeah.
And so you've had this kind of remarkable experience of spending 10 years in Hartford and then going to Baltimore
yeah.
and which are two cities that are, you know, essentially East Coast cities. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to be in St. Louis starting in June.
Yes.
How would you characterize the differences in terms of the audience or the theater making that happens in those regions?
Well, you know, I think that there are certain things. So when you're looking at New England is its own, I think, it has its own unique idiosyncrasies.
Sure.
I was in Hartford for 10 years, and then I went to Boston, and I actually found that Hartford and Boston were not incredibly different in terms of who the audience was, the types of plays that were being taken on by the larger regional theaters, so there was a kind of New England sensibility to it.
Yeah.
I found Baltimore to be refreshingly different from my first two experiences, because then I started to think, oh, is this what it's like at every regional theater? I grew up in Houston. I grew up around the Alley and going to see theater there. And the Alley has a resident company, and the resident company had a demographic that was very kind of specific. Very few people of color in that company at the time. I don't know how it will evolve under new leadership, but and so, you know, I knew always that I wouldn't see stories or people necessarily who look like me on the stage there. When I got to Baltimore, the demographics of the city it's a city that's 50% Black, that before Kwame, during Irene Lewis's year, she made a deep investment in blowing open which stories get told on stage. And so Kwame inherited a theater where it was not abnormal for there to be more than one play by an artist of color on stage, right? Which was kind of the slot mentality right. of the regional theater that I grew up in, yes. where it's like, oh, well, it's Black History Month. It's February. Anywhere right. in the country, you look in February, that's where you're going to see your Black or Latinx play because there can only be one. And it's going to yeah. be, you know, January, February slot. That slot mentality did not exist when I got to Baltimore. And I think that predated Kwame. Kwame was able to really build upon that and stretch the form of the work that we were seeing by artists of color. And so it was exciting that you had an audience that was more diverse to begin with than the audiences that I'd been working with previously. And there was already a level of vocabulary around expanding the canon and embracing these like A-list talents, right? Yeah. The issue has never been that there aren't talented enough writers of color or directors of color or artists of color to be on stages. It's just a matter of like who's at the table deciding who gets those opportunities. Yeah. Because I have to tell you, there's some, well, we know, right? The world has kind of blown open. But even 20 years ago, the number of extraordinary voices of writers and directors of color who were not getting looks in the regionals was really problematic. And I felt like during my time in New England, there was a lot of like putting names on the table, really advocating for artists that I believed in. And I found that I didn't have to work as hard when I got to Baltimore to yeah. do that, because there was already a vocabulary for it. There was already yes. a hunger for it. And so it was exciting to be able to run faster than I had been the last 10 yeah. years in the next five. What I think is interesting about going to St. Louis in this moment is that St. Louis is, and Baltimore, well, as a child of Texas, a Texan who also did undergrad in Georgia, I wouldn't quite call Baltimore the South. It's certainly Southern compared to New England.
Yeah.
And so there are some Southern sensibilities that I found great ease with. But when I look at St. Louis, it has a very similar demographic. While it's in the Midwest, and I've never lived in the Midwest, it's a city that's 50% Black. It's also a city that very much like Baltimore has been in the public eye because of issues around race in this country yeah. and has had to survive the trauma of those events. And I think that that changes it imprints on a city and it changes a city. And to have been in Baltimore when Freddie Gray was murdered to have been producing art at that time that was really powerful and an important part of how we made it through that time. And I think yes. how the city embraced that time. I think a deep emotional understanding of what it means in a city that is a wonderful, beautiful city, but having to rebuild its kind of national yeah. Face and having to tackle the very real issues because they've been surfaced in yes. a way that they haven't been in other cities. And so, I feel like the time in Baltimore is really valuable because there are some similarities between those two cities. I have to say that the time that I spent in St. Louis thus far has been incredible. Mm. The city is really beautiful. The spirit of the people is really beautiful. It's been so welcoming. I'm looking forward to digging in to meeting all of the different artists and other leaders of arts organizations. Baltimore has very few theaters. Yeah. There's kind of like Baltimore Center Stage, and then there are kind of two handfuls of smaller to mid-sized theaters, and maybe not even two handfuls. Well, whereas in St. Louis, there are actually a very large number of smaller theaters and interesting work happening. And so I'm looking forward to seeing as much art as I can, getting connected and talking to as many artists in the community as possible, and really thinking about the work and the future of the rep around how we can be of service. Like where can we help fill artistic needs and lives
yeah.
and how can we expand access to the work, because the work is incredible. How do we expand access to the work? How do we bring the best and brightest voices to St. Louis? Because I think that St. Louis deserves to be producing the work of some of the most phenomenal voices in our country. And I love that that looks like the world that we live in.
Yeah. You, in addition to your work as a director and being, you know, one of this new class of amazing leaders that are taking the reins of some of our biggest institutions, you're also a mom.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could, you know, have any advice for other directors who are considering motherhood, or other directors who are mothers and who are trying to, like, make the career happen simultaneous with raising a child in the world that we live in today, with the demands of the regional theaters.
I mean, I think that the first thing we just have to say is that our field, the field that I grew up in, was not naturally inclined to support parenthood, be it motherhood, fatherhood, whatever. The idea of being a roaming nomad, the hours that we do, there was nothing about the structure of the American theater that said, it's okay to be a mom, and we're going to support you through this. And there was a lot, there were a lot of growing pains along the way. I'm really grateful during my time in Hartford that I had the opportunities that I had. I think that when I decided to have a child, that it probably scared some folks because there hadn't been a baby in the theater for a very long time. I was actually really lucky. Laura Eason, we were producing a world premiere of one of her plays, and she was very, very pregnant, and ended up having the baby like 2 or 3 weeks before we went into rehearsal.
Okay.
And so we had to accommodate a new mother in rehearsal for a world premiere play, and her husband was cast in the play. And so, and I was producing it. And so it was like, we need a comfy chair and we need a place for her to, you know, nurse and pump. And we you know, and suddenly the theater was forced to find a way, right, to support a new mom in process.
Yeah.
And I was very, very pregnant at the time. So I was like, oh, this is a great test. And then, you know, when I had my daughter, I went back to rehearsal with a 5-week-old attached to my body. She was 2 weeks old, and I was like doing Skype meetings for Gym of the Ocean. Mm-hmm. And my sister, God bless her soul, took off a month and a half from work to come and be with me. And we turned the music room into a nursery. Mm. And on my 10-minute breaks, I would run in and I would be like pumping and breastfeeding. Yep. And, you know, when people got difficult in the rehearsal room, I would be like, bring the baby in, bring the baby in. She calms people down. It was, in retrospect, it was insane. I do not recommend going back into the rehearsal room 6 days a week with a baby that young. But we were in transition, and I remember feeling like it's what I had to do.
Yeah.
I also recognize that part of what happened for me was connected to the privilege of the position I had in the theater. Our artistic director was leaving. We were in the middle of transition. I was the associate artistic director.
Right.
I was producing all of the work at the theater. And so they needed me and I needed my baby.
Yeah.
And so during that time, my daughter was with me at work every day. She was born in February. My mother came in June. So from February to June, she had a pack and play. She was with me. She was everywhere I went, she went. I also recognize that part of why I have the career I have and have been able to I've had more ease, I will say, which is not to say it was easy in any way, is because my mother has been a tremendous gift to me. She retired after I had my daughter. And the first 2 years of my daughter's life, you know, anytime I had a job, my mother would fly out from Texas and my mother and my daughter would travel with me.
Yeah.
And I know every director, every artist is different. I found it comforting to have my daughter with me. I didn't find it distracting to have my daughter in the city where I was working. I felt like coming home to her at the end of every rehearsal and on my lunch breaks was rejuvenating.
Yeah.
And it made me believe, oh, this is possible, right? Like, I can be an artist and a mother. Yes. I can, you know, put my daughter to bed and come back into rehearsal, you know? So before she started school, those years were really wonderful because she was just with me. And I know that part of that was because I had the support system of someone who could travel with me and could help me with the care of my daughter. When I left Baltimore, when I left Hartford, I was really clear. I said I wasn't going to work for an institution for a couple of years, that I realized that I had been racing towards a dream for 10 years and that I wasn't the same person I was a decade earlier.
Yep.
I'd had this a child, and and when you're in the regional theater, when you're working, you know, you're producing, it's like, you're like triaging, right? You're putting out fires, you're putting up shows. There's no time to think about the big questions.
Yes.
There's no time for meditation and deep, you know, existential crisis. Like, just no time to fall apart and figure out who you want to be.
Yeah.
And I said to myself when I left Hartford that I wanted to take the time to figure out if the dreams I had at 24 were still the dreams I had at 34.
Mm.
And if they weren't, to figure out who I wanted to be in this art form. The other thing that I realized is that I came in to Hartford with the express purpose of learning these best practices and taking it back to my scrappy theater company, right? And so during that time, I was working for Arts Emerson, but I was also freelancing as a producer and working with a lot of smaller companies. And I found that to be incredibly gratifying for me. It was like a full circle moment. I wasn't coming back to my company, but I was doing exactly what I set out to do, which is like, not only did I learn these tools and steal these tools, I remastered them, I re-engineered them, now let me give them to you so that you can run.
Yes.
And I had the opportunity to actually get kind of spiritually clear about what I wanted for the future. And I will say that this has been my experience of how the universe works. As soon as I was clear that I wanted to go back into the regional theater and I wanted to be artistic director of a major regional theater, I kid you not, my phone started ringing. And I had two job offers to be associate artistic director at two different theaters before Kwame called. And then when I started talking to Kwame, I had made a list of like all the things I wanted to do in my next gig. And they were like impossible things, right?
Yes.
There were things that no one in the American theater was doing. Like, I was combining things that didn't make any sense.
What's on the list?
There are so many things. But one of the things on the list, for example, was I was very interested in this nexus point between art and technology.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to explore what it would mean to expand our understanding of what theater is. And when Kwame and I started talking, he pitched to me this idea that he had been working on at Baltimore called CS Digital.
Yes.
And I was like, what happened? Like, did you just read off my list all the things I want to do next? And so when the universe provided that, I was like, I can't possibly say no to this. This is like all of the things literally on my list. And I found a great friend and collaborator and advocate in Mr. Quay Amar.
Yes.
And one of the things when we were interviewing for the job, he was telling me all the things that he was looking for. And I said, that's great. I can do all of that for you. Here's what I need. I said, my husband's a consultant. He's on the road 4 or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
I need my child with me. And Kwame said to me, that's not going to be a problem. You can have your daughter here every single day. He's like, I don't really like dogs, but I like children. And we put it to the test. I mean, I showed up my first day of work with my daughter in tow. And, you know, Kwame helped put her desk together, set on the floor of my office and helped build her desk. And until she was in kindergarten, she was with me at work virtually every day. You know, I make a break in my meeting schedule so I could go pick her up from school, and then she'd come in, and she, you know, I might be in a meeting and I come back and I'm like, where's my daughter? And they're like, oh, she's up in auditions with Kwame. And I go in and she's stamping people's headshots, sitting at the table with him stamping headshots.
Amazing.
So what was wonderful about that experience was that I realized that every theater is in control of the culture.
That's right.
And every theater makes decisions about how responsive and adaptive they're going to be to the needs of the parents that work for them. And I found Baltimore to be, again, a forward-thinking theater. You know, there were moms in our development office who ended up doing flexible schedules because that's what worked best for them. There were, you know, there are often children in the theater, in our theater. There are more parents at Baltimore Center Stage than I think any other theater that I've worked at. And, you know, my daughter is rarely now when she has her own life, so she's not there as much as I would like for her to be. But when she comes into the building, she's rarely the only child in the building. Oh. You know, other people's kids come after school and, you know, she slides into rehearsal and I think that she's a more evolved child now because she's grown up in the American theater. You know, she's been in tech since she was, you know, 2 months old.
I loved seeing her office the last time we hung out at Baltimore Center Stage. She totally has her own setup in your office.
She does.
I can't take up your whole day. I know you have a rehearsal to get to. So I just have time for one more question, which is, you know, as part of this new class of leaders, young leaders, assuming the reins of these major legacy institutions, what do you think some of the kind of big challenges are that you can see ahead, not just for you, but for the whole field?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that we have a structural issue within the American Regional Theater, that the model that was created 50 to 60 years ago, that the economy has changed, the consumption practices of our audiences have changed, the funding communities and imperatives have changed, but our structures have not adapted. And so, you know, I feel like I've been sitting at national conferences for the last 15, 20 years, and everyone's talking about how the system is failing and we've got to find a new model and, but there hasn't been space for, part of it is just the nature of where we are as a field, certainly for the regionals financially, but there's been no space for R&D. There's been very little space for failure. And so when you cannot take any risk because the stakes for failing are so high, then it is impossible to really do the type of epic critical thinking necessary to really solve these fundamental problems of the field. And I do feel that our class has been kind of, we're being handed these institutions with these very real structural problems and we're expected to be able to come up with the next big idea, but with very little capacity for risk. And I feel like building capacity for risk, building capacity for us to be able to be really innovative and exploratory in the way that we think about restructuring is important. And I think it's one of the big questions that we're going to have to figure out how to answer. And I think that there's some real conversations that need to be had within the funding community and also within our audiences, within our respective local communities about how we can support the evolution of our institutions. We are all facing, in addition to the potential financial issues that I think are field-wide, questions of relevancy. And I feel like those questions are actually a little bit easier to tackle because there are lots of great, interesting, innovative voices that just haven't had the opportunity. And what happens when you support the opportunity with the type of institutional support, right? So we have organizations that have always had kind of single term marketing, right? There's like one marketing brochure, there's one big push that goes out. Instead of niche marketing, instead of being able to really speak to people in the language that they understand, the expectation that you will put out one thing and everyone will come, it's not part of the reality of what it means in 2019 to be producing anything, let alone theater. And so it's about what work you're putting on stage, who's getting to tell those stories, but also how you're supporting making sure that those stories are being heard and that people have access to it. And I actually think it's not a matter of like ticket price.
No.
I think that that's like this narrative that's been floating for 20 years that's just not real. And I think there's plenty of studies that have proven that to be the point.
Yeah.
It's how do I make people know that what I'm putting on stage is relevant and meaningful to your life?
Yeah.
And that's a very big shift, I think, in the way that we think about how we talk about the art and why it's important and how we invite people in. And I think that I'm excited about tackling those challenges, and I'm excited about sharing and hearing from my colleagues in this dynamic class of new artistic directors, how we're all in our individual cities working to solve these issues, and what are the practices. You know, I'm like, let's share and share very openly and very transparently. If something's working for me, I want you to know. If something's working for you, I want to beg, borrow, and steal it. Yeah. If something's not working, I want all these minds working with me to help figure out whether I need to move to a new idea or we just haven't cracked the code. And I think that there is a spirit and energy that I already feel with all of these artistic directors of like, we're in this together. It's not about what I can do for my theater. This is about this field that we love. And the more honest and transparent we can be with each other, the better it's going to be for the field.
We're going to succeed together.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you have coming up that our listeners can come check out? This is opening night tonight at Marin Theater Company.
It is. Opening night for the Who and the What. It's been such an incredible journey here at Marin. The cast is amazing. So if you're in the Bay Area, please come out and see that.
Plays till like the end of March or early April?
I believe it plays until early April.
Okay, great.
And then my last kind of project before I head off into the sunset to St. Louis, in Baltimore, I'm directing Porgy and Bess with the symphony.
Oh my God.
And that will be the second week of April. It will be in performances at the symphony. So if you're going to be in the DMV area, please come out to see the play that changed my life.
Yes.
I finally get to my hands on it. So
that's a beautiful full circle.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sitting down.
Thank you for inviting me.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.